KPCW News Time now, 8:09. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher in the studio with us now with our Trails Report, Charlie Sturgis from Mountain Trails. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So what have you got out there? Dry trails?
We got some dry trails. You know, I think what we got going on out there. First off, we're side vegging a lot. So the Mountain Trails and Centerville Basin both are out there trying to clean up some of this growth that's starting to kind of get into the middle of the trail, make it hard to see what you're doing. We do have a couple things that I think are pretty exciting that are completed. One that is kind of a favorite for me at the moment. We did scratch in a hiking trail from Spiro to Dawn. So basically we extended Dawn's trail to help people have an option immediately to not walk up Spiro. So our goal is to have people not walk up Spiro. It's not really that safe to do. And certainly when you get a lot of hikers on Spiro, it's just the chances of having a disaster with someone coming downhill pretty fast is, you know, gets better. So anyhow, if you're a hiker in that area, and if you haven't hiked Dawn's to Armstrong, it's actually a really good way to go versus going up Armstrong, because you're always looking at the cyclists coming towards you, dogs and all that. Everything's coming at you. It's just way more comfortable way to do it. So take advantage of that opportunity. Of course, if you're coming over from Silver Spur, first time lift area, that's the way to pick it up. And if you want, you can always pick it up from Silver Star as well. So,
can we talk a little bit just about, because I've heard a couple of incidents of, we're talking trail rage here. And this was an incident of somebody walking up Armstrong with a leashed dog and a mountain biker coming down Armstrong, not maybe.
Which is a no-no right off
the bat. Absolutely,
yeah.
Right. And then, like, hurling rocks at him after they called him out on it. I mean, are you hearing any of these kind of incidents?
I haven't heard that one. Mm. You know, it's, we're all out there to have a good time and try to relax, and that's certainly not part of relaxing. So even if things aren't perfect out there, as I like to say, you know, every once in a while someone really tells me about a bad incident, how it ruined their day. I go, well, don't let one whatever ruin your day, right? It's just, it isn't worth it. So, you know, just figure that I always like to say that, you know, there's 3 or 4 or 5% of them, people out there, users out there in general, that aren't going to get it. The good news is 95% of us do. So, and of that 95%, sometimes people are not as well and as informed as maybe we are locally because we use it all the time, but their intention is never wrong. So, you know, there's a few people, yeah, just like when you drive, right, there's a few people out there that just, you know, it's all about them and they don't get it. The flip side is most of us are pretty good. So I like to go to bed thinking that at night and wake up that way. All right. On the other side of that, the other good news, though, the trail we've been working on in Round Valley, which is also directional, it's going to be directional up. There's several purposes for this trail as well. One is it's designed with adaptive cycling in mind. So a four-wheel, a hand-pedaled bike can get up it, you know, with some ease. A visitor could get up it, or, you know, young family members could get up it. So it's pretty casual up. It hits the high point of Nowhere Elks, and eventually we'll have downhill only flow trail that corresponds with this. That will probably be later in the season at this point. So that is actually complete and ready to go as well. It's a little dusty, a little loose until we get some rain on it. That's the way that it's going to be. And currently, the other exciting thing we probably will finish up by the end of next week, hopefully, is we are doing an extension of Shadow Lake Loop Trail that will take you to Scott's Pass. So there will be no more riding the gully or the dirt road that we have admittedly ridden for 30-some years. But that trail's we're starting to work up there right now, and that hopefully will be done by the end of next week. So those are some pretty cool things going on out there. Otherwise, yeah, be safe. Try not to use your brakes too much in terms of erosion and tearing up the trail. Use your brakes for speed, please. But get out there, have fun, and just let's hopefully get some a little bit of rain in here and enjoy it.
Yeah, let's talk just briefly about e-bikes, because we're seeing more and more of those on the trails, even though they're not allowed. But really, there's no signs out there telling people that. I mean, there's no motorized vehicles, but right. I don't think people think an electric motor is a motorized vehicle.
I think you probably have a good point there that we probably need to catch up on that signage. I'm not seeing them on the trails. I'm seeing a lot of e-bikes. And in one sense, you know, when I was running around on 4th of July, I'm going, I probably saw 20, 30 e-bikes. And when I go over to the Mark, I see 5, 6 e-bikes in the bike rack and go, well, those are all not cars, right? So those people have eliminated the use of their car for that time. So that's pretty cool. And I am seeing at times, I bet you some days I see 30, 40 e-bikes out on paths. The deal is still the same. E-bikes are not allowed on single track. We could do a better job of signing it, I guess. There is always the flip side is just how many signs do you need out there before you just have too many signs? I mean, I think there should be signs warning that there, you know, you have switchbacks coming, you know, so that you can avoid stutter bumps. And we go back and forth about this all the time. It's fairly, I mean, the users who are out there on the trails, they know. They know they're not supposed to be there. Or there's a few of them that are older than myself that I would cut the slack for any time. So there are a couple I know that get out there, and these guys are well into their 70s, and they're out there riding. God bless them. That's all I'm going to say about it. Right. So, you know, and, you know, the bike shops locally, almost everybody has e-bikes for rent now and or for sale, which is, you know, 2 years ago, you would never even thought you'd see that. And most of them are equipped more for path bikeways than they are for trails. So we'll just keep hoping that's the way it goes. And certainly the ski areas have not taken to renting e-bikes. They feel like they want to stay pretty much in the same mode as the city. And hopefully I'm not misquoting them. I don't believe so. So hopefully we just keep this down on the wide paths where they truly belong, except for where maybe there's an exception or two in terms of physical abilities, which the ordinance does allow for.
Yeah. It'll just be interesting, though. I mean, you know, we see what we see now versus just the growth in just the last couple of years. I mean, looking 20 years out, I mean, well, I guess we won't.
It's crazy, but it's once again, you know, as I like to say, no gun is dangerous until you put it in someone's hands. And e-bikes, the same thing. We can easily go faster on our mountain bikes than you might go on an e-bike. But the potential to have more reckless riding or potentially incidents because of lack of skill is definitely higher when you have an e-bike involved. We're not tearing up the trails worse. There's none of that. It's, you know, some people worry about it. You're really looking at closing speeds and people's inability to manage a bike that weighs 50 pounds. And maybe having a really small rider on it, because you do see some kids on these bikes, and you go, whoa, that doesn't look like a safe situation. Bike weighs half as much as they do. So anyhow, let's hope that everyone just practices good safety common sense, right?
Okay. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Thanks, Leslie. You
Thanks,
bet.
Charlie. It's 8:19 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, on Tuesday, the Park City Rotary Club handed out $125,000 in grant money to local nonprofit organizations that help children in the Park City area. In the studio with details, I have Rotarians Tom Kelly and Peter Wright. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Leslie.
Tom, we'll start with you and maybe just give us a little bit of a background on the Rotary Club and how you guys came up with the money to do this.
Well, thank you and appreciate the opportunity. Rotary Club in Park City has been around since 1980. And for those who may not know about Rotary, it's an international service club. Was started over a century ago with a million members around the world and engaged in a variety of humanitarian causes, both locally and globally. And one of the most notable is that Rotary has been influential in ending polio around the world. But right here in Park City, we've been involved in a whole variety of projects over the years. Miner's Day Festival, of course, being one of them, very, very well known, coming up on September 4th this year. The Giving Tree Festival that takes place during the holiday season. And we've been giving out grants for quite a few years, but generally been fairly small grants. And we found ourselves in a position a few years ago at Rotary where we had a good amount of money in the bank, and the club made a decision to either leave it there and grow or to spend it and give it to some good causes in the community. We decided to do the latter and give it out and do some good.
Okay, because you do these grants often. I mean, I know that KPCW has been a recipient, but they've been more of the $500,000. I mean, you went big with this one.
Yeah, we've in the past taken the approach, and we still do in our annual giving program. The grants are much smaller, but we touch more organizations. What we wanted to do here when we found ourselves with a lot of money in the bank is to withdraw a good sum of that and be able to give out just a few grants in a large amount that would really make a difference.
All right. Well, Peter Wright, you oversaw the community outreach that resulted in these three selections. So talk a little bit about the process, if you would, in terms of how you guys came to just these three.
Okay. Not an easy process. Our club really hadn't had any experience in giving away sizable sums of money. So we set about sort of establishing what policies how would we make award decisions, how would we choose. And once we did that, we did, I think, the old-fashioned thing. We just got out and we started to talk to a lot of people. We just moved around the community, interviewing people that we thought had a good handle on what the needs were, because the first decision we had made as a group was that we were going to focus on needs, not wants, in the community. So we were looking for what are the core serious needs, things that really are affecting this community, and that's what we turned our attention to.
So did it just happen that these three organizations are those that help children, or was that kind of what you came to? It's like the kids need help here.
It's an odd thing. We reached originally out wide and far just to find out what existed in terms of needs, and we just... We did this over a period of a year. We decided not to hurry because we felt that time would give us a better perspective on the community. So at one of our meetings, we just sort of looked around the table because we were all talking about issues that centered around kids and young adults. And it dawned on us that's where we had moved, and so we just followed that.
Yeah. So did you require applications from all of these organizations?
No. After sorting needs and getting a general direction, then we turned to the nonprofit community and started talking to nonprofits that we felt had a role to play and a solid involvement in the directions we were concerned with and interested in. And just started talking with them in depth as to where they were going, what hurdles were they finding, what monies did they need, what might they do with the monies we had available. And that got us to our final destination.
Well, let's talk about the three. The Community for Children's Justice, this is the Justice Center.
Yes.
Bright Futures, which helps first-generational kids get to college
and through
college, yeah. And then PC Tots, which is the daycare center.
Yeah.
So maybe you can just talk a little bit about how much those organizations received and what they're going to do with the money.
We granted $50,000 to the Community for Children's Justice, and the purpose there is to help them with their funding for new facilities. Their current facilities out at Kimball Junction are inappropriate for the situation. And really, kids that have been abused to the very least deserve a facility that's designed purposely to take care of them, help them recover, help them go through the legal and law enforcement processes that are involved in the least painful and most constructive manner. And so a facility designed for that purpose is critical. So we $50,000 for that organization. And Bright Futures, of course, that's the young adults. The organization's focused on families that have no college experience in the family. So therefore, these students who might be going to college or considering it don't have sort of peer information and background to guide them through the process, and even to understand what it's all about. So Bright Futures is a mentoring program to take those kids starting at the end of the ninth grade through and go to a training camp in the summer, and then preparing them both for being prepared academically as well, but also applying for, getting into college, funding it, and then, of course, the main thing is to get them all the way through and out the other end as graduates.
And how much did they receive?
They received $50,000 as well.
Okay. And then PC Tots?
PC Tots, that organization is pretty well known in the community. its big advantage, I think, is in two directions. One, the hours of the day and hours of the week that it provides service is broader than most other daycare centers. And they give scholarships and reduce costs to help working families that don't have a very high income, because daycare is very expensive. And specifically, we funded basically the playground equipment that they have. They had a debt for that, and we paid off. Our funds are to pay off the debt, so that money becomes useful to them. And we're very pleased that we could do that, and we gave them $25,000.
Well, and I was going to note that you didn't, Lynn, look at, I mean, the fact that P.C. Todd's had won not only the $30,000 Women's Giving Fund, but then a $250,000 grant from Vail Resorts or Epic Promise. So those guys are swimming
in
cash.
Well, the Epic Promise money is sort of obviously a very sizable amount of money, but its sole purpose was to open a second facility for P.C. Todd's. So none of that money is available for scholarships in the other facility or for the playground equipment or other things that are expenses related to the original facility. So we found a need there and thought it was well worth supporting.
Yeah. So do you require any updates or anything from them, or you just hand the money?
Well, aside of this, that we hope works well in the future is more involvement by our members with each of these organizations, not for the sense necessarily of following up and seeing if our money is doing what we intended to do, but more in a partnership. I think there are ways we can help those organizations, and I think there's a reward and payback to our members by involvement there.
Okay, so they've got money in hand, huh?
They've got money in hand.
Nice. How long is it going to take to save up that kind of money again, Tom?
I don't know, but, you know, we're pretty excited about it. And I have to say, I was not a part of the process itself. In fact, going back 2 years ago when we did the vote, I voted to keep the money in the bank. But as soon as this came to the board last fall, I sat on the board of Rotary. It just brought tears to my eyes, because you think about the good that we can do in this community. And, you know, you mentioned a few other groups here, and I think we should all be very proud in this community that we have entities like the Park City Foundation and the Women's Giving Fund, Park City Rotary Club, Epic Promise. And these are amazing granting organizations that really make our community a better place to live. And it just makes you as a Rotarian feel really proud to do this and really want to get out there and, you know, sell a little bit more beer and some more sponsorships at Miners Day so we can do this again in another year or two.
Right. So it wouldn't take that long.
Oh,
huh?
It probably will, but I think there's a great spirit in the club right now for activities. We started the Giving Tree Festival just a year ago, and we've got a big mayoral forum coming up this Tuesday. So there's a lot of activity within Rotary right now that we hope will spur enthusiasm, bring more money into our coffers so we can give it back to deserving causes.
Right. Okay. Anything else you want to mention?
No, I just want to thank everybody in the community. We're proud of what we did in Rotary, and Park City is a great place to live, and this is a good indicator. But we have challenges, and hopefully we can help with those.
And I just wanted to clarify that this is the Park City Rotary Lunch Club that raised all this money. This wasn't a joint partnership with the Breakfast Club, huh?
No, it was not. We have two Rotary clubs in town, and each of them are doing, you know, great work like this. So we're proud to be part of Rotary here in Park City.
Okay. Hey, Peter, Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thank you,
thanks.
Leslie.
KPCW News Time now, 8:30. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, the Park City Council met last night in the studio with a recap of some of the items discussed. We've got Councilmember Tim Henney. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Leslie.
During work session, Councilmember Andy Bierman suggested that while the city's doing some sort of analysis, that maybe we also find out how many renters we've got in Park City. And that led to Mayor Thomas asking if it's possible to change the code regarding nightly rentals. Can you... What is it that's being suggested here?
Well, we do have a concern about what happened to Old Town as an example. What happens to neighborhoods in general when you allow nightly rentals and you convert those neighborhoods from full-time residences to people who buy second homes or buy investment properties and then rent them out on a nightly basis as opposed to long-term? It definitely changes the fundamental character of the neighborhood. We saw that happen in Old Town. And we're curious as to whether or not there's any data that shows the impacts of Airbnb-type operations in our various neighborhoods. We're concerned about actually that change bleeding out into other neighborhoods, which we do have evidence that that's happening to some degree across the community. So I think it's just a data point. We'd like to kind of see if we're doing this analysis, is there a way to add that in?
Right. But there's little you can do about it, isn't it? Isn't this something that got brought back up at the legislature?
You remember? It didn't. I don't think it got brought back up at the legislature. But my recollection, and this goes back a long time, is that when the issue about nightly rentals bubbled up to the council level here in Park City, and this might have been 15 or maybe even 20 years ago, it seemed like a good idea to restrict nightly rentals in Old Town. That was the proposal. And a significant portion of the community came out vehemently opposed to that. And it was people who either had a direct link to those investment properties, had bought them under the belief that they would be able to rent them out nightly, people who had already bought, people who were purchasing, and it was basically focused in the real estate industry, and they came out across the board against it, and it was voted down.
So we just want to know how many, are we actually talking about perhaps trying to restrict nightly rental somehow?
Well, I think the mayor brought up the example of Old Town and asked, is there something that we could do? So I think it's an exploratory doing inquiry at this point. And if that inquiry leads to us thinking that there are threads that need to be pursued and bring something to the surface again, it would be, it's a new time. A couple of decades have gone by and we've seen the effects and the changes, and it might be time to have that conversation with the community again. And this would be a way to do that.
Discussion on microtransit. Where are we on this? The request for proposal was or will be re-advertised?
It will be re-advertised, and I think there were a number of significant adjustments made that address the concerns that were brought forward to us by our local transportation coalition and providers, and they'll have an opportunity to, and now they've got a full heads up and everything's, out there, and I think that was a great process. The process worked exactly the way it was supposed to. So, it'll be reissued.
So will the new request make it easier for local for-hire drivers to participate or possibly get the contract?
Well, easier, I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on if you've got a fleet of electric vehicles, it might be easier. I don't know that there's any local provider that has a fleet of electric vehicles. They could certainly go out and lease the vehicles, which I think was the last RFP ended up with. Everybody who was in that selection process was going to go either purchase or lease vehicles to provide the service. So, our local coalition could put together a number or a coalition that could then lease some vehicles and compete for this service.
Well, is that the council's priority here, to have electric vehicles over local drivers?
We had that conversation, and yes, that is a priority.
Over local drivers. I mean, why does it matter that they're an electric vehicle?
I think that's pretty obvious. It's electric vehicles are the future, we believe, of transportation, and we're going to help our local providers shift to that mode of transportation if we can.
So do you think the Downtowner group will be applying again? Or were they?
I can't speculate, but I'd be surprised if they didn't. I guess I'd be, slightly surprised if they didn't. They might look at the RFP or the requirements and determine that they don't want to apply, but that's anybody can do that. It's up to all the different service providers taking a look, seeing if they can meet the criteria, if they'd like to try to meet the criteria, and filing an application. Yeah.
Yeah. So the new deadline then is when?
I don't remember the exact dates, but it's pretty quick. It's coming up in August, I believe. I think maybe the RFP goes out within the next week or two, and the selection happens, I believe, early to mid-August.
All right. And then it could start as soon as?
I think it kind of keeps us on the same timeline of getting this thing up and rolling late summer and hopefully having it into, the transition through shoulder and into peak season to give us some, data.
Council received a staff update with regard to the plastic bag ban that went into effect last month. You said that the bag ban has been phenomenal. You think that the retailers are coming around. Are you just referring to the three stores that were impacted by the ban, or are we seeing other stores follow suit here, even though they don't have
right.
to?
I haven't seen any other stores following suit. That would be, you know, that would be really great. But what I do think is phenomenal is that the three impacted stores have embraced this, and they're making, you know, I think their narrative, I'd love to hear their narrative, and I think at some point we will get a narrative from them as opposed to going through the filter of, you know, Luke Curtin and sustainability or anybody else, because we heard from them when we were considering implementing the ban, and their narrative was that people are going to go shop at Smith's because that's where they get free plastic bags, and it would impact their business. And I believe, from what I've seen, is that people are shopping at our local businesses because they have banned plastic bags. And I think that's they've embraced that. I've seen them giving away bags. I've seen them offering for sale cheap bags. And the place is packed and everybody's bringing their own reusable bags. And it, from what I see, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, and there's the outliers, of course. But the staff report says that people haven't complained about the bag ban, and that's not what one of the store managers told somebody who called me to tell me that our report was inaccurate, that people haven't complained. This resident told me that when she spoke to the store manager, he told her that he had had plenty of complaints. So, I mean, what is it? The staff didn't ask, didn't talk to the managers, or they're not reporting accurately what the managers are telling other people? I mean, we're hearing two stories here.
Yeah, good question, Leslie. I'm not sure. What the story we're hearing is we aren't getting any complaints at the city. We can, you know, say that with accuracy. We have been told by the stores from our sustainability department that they are not getting what they would consider to be a level of complaint. I don't know the exact numbers, but I would think there's some threshold where, as you say, there are always going to be the outliers that are going to complain about anything. So everybody has to factor that in. But we are being told that they are not receiving complaints that I guess exceed a certain threshold that they would consider to be significant. And because of that, they have embraced this and they're making the best of it and they're aligning with community values, and I think it, as I said, I do believe it's phenomenal.
Luke Curtin told council there's a group doing a bag bank. What is that?
That's the coalition that kind of brought this to us, Sherelle Rodman and some other people who, they're going to collect bags and they're going to, the idea is to have bags that are available for people at the locations in a, use and return sort of thing. If you use it one time, please bring it back or add to it. If you have extra bags, if you got 15 bags in your car and you only want 5, take 10 and put it in the bag bank and then they're there for people to use.
All right, let's see. Bonanza Flat, Utah Open Lands Executive Director Wendy Fisher presented a plan for managing Bonanza Flat. Council was saying, though, that you want to be careful through this process. She's been doing this a long time. And what about her presentation concerned you?
I didn't really have any concerns. One of the things Wendy said right off the bat was that, you know, people are asking, why is this taking so long? And I was like, what? Why is this taking so long? We just closed on the deal. It seems to be moving along on a timeline that I'm certainly comfortable with. I guess the only thing that I brought up for consideration, and I'm sure that, you know, they responded that this is fully factored in, is we have, Brighton Estates right next door, and a number of those year-round homeowners played a significant role. They have had access issues over the years. They have used this property. They're kind of eyes and feet on the ground that we could use in a positive way. We certainly want to be sensitive to, you know, their historic use and access to their cabins and their properties because they are full-time residents, even though they're in Wasatch County. And were they being fully integrated into the process? And the response was, yes, they are. So, you know, that was the issue that I questioned about. The timeline, I'm very comfortable with. The process, I'm very comfortable with. And we just kind of got an update and an overview of, you know, here's where we are and here's what we're doing.
What about the budget? Do we know? Do we have a budget for
it? We don't have that, but that's part of this process. They're going to arrive at a budget. And, you know, there's an awful, as you said, Wendy Fisher's been doing this for an awful long time. You have to create a baseline survey so that you can monitor against that and, you know, in the following years and determine if there have been changes and if there have been impacts from use or if there have been impacts from noxious weeds and if there's impact to the water quality and all those sorts of things. So this is the very early stage, and, yeah, it'll take some time, but they always do.
Councilmember Becca Gerber asked that parking be addressed as soon as possible. is that a top priority, or do you have other priorities personally?
Well, I think Becca's just pointing out that, you know, every season we just see more and more cars up there because they're drawn up there for the scenic beauty and also the hikes that are available into some of those lakes. But the parking that she's talking about is the parking up there between Little Cottonwood Canyon or Big Cottonwood Canyon and our side, and then, of course, Park City side and Wasatch County side. We've got two summits there that have sort of these parking lots that have just occurred through use over the years, and then we have the Brighton Estates parking, and then we have the paved road down into Midway. So all those factors are contributing to an awful lot of parking and congestion up there, and it increases every year. So if there's a way to manage that as opposed to just let it happen, it's the same idea about, you know, letting people wander around mountains versus putting in trails. You put in trails, you know where they're going to go. They're going to go on the trails, and they won't be scattered all over your mountain. So if you're concerned about that, put in some trails. If you're concerned about parking scattering all over the road and all over the place, put in some parking lots, and guess what? That's where people will park, and you can manage it that way.
We're waiting for Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox to call in. We'll be talking about the 25K jobs tour, so stay tuned for that. But wanted to quickly ask you, Tim, about you got a bit lit up last night when talking about the planning commissioner's comments about how the city council had handled the application for the 1450-1460 Park Avenue affordable housing project from last month's meeting. You said that you either don't understand the process or the Planning Commission doesn't understand their role. So what is it?
Well, and there was a third option also. And the third option was that there was a flaw in the process. So I just was looking for clarity on that, and I got the clarity. But, you know, bottom line is if the Planning Commission feels that there's something that's flawed with the process, then instead of sending forward a positive recommendation, they should deny it, and it should come to City Council, and we should have that policy discussion, because that's how you build the legitimacy in the process. You don't call something illegitimate and then forward a positive recommendation.
So have we fixed it, or do we need to go back and...
No, there was nothing to fix. You know, that was part of the discussion. Our planning director said, no, there was a legitimate process, and this did meet code. And, you know, if planning commissioners have an issue with that, there's a process to address it.
I think there was a difference because this didn't come in as a master plan development, and so then that was why it was allowed to come in sort of piecemeal like it did?
Yeah, it wasn't a usual, normal process, and there was some frustration expressed about that. And, you know, I think this is good for the process because when there are issues, they need to be highlighted. The Planning Commission did highlight their frustration that this was not normal. But, you know, my problem with it was if you're going to talk about hypocrisy and you're going to talk about preferential treatment and you're going to talk about how private sector development would never get this sort of leniency or these sort of decisions on their behalf, then don't approve it. Deny it, which an initial motion was made to deny, and it failed for lack of a second. But that, in my mind, would have been the appropriate action to take. Don't sit there and complain and call it hypocrisy and call into question the process and then forward a positive recommendation. Are you kidding me? I mean, you know, so in there somewhere is a very fundamental misunderstanding. Either the Planning Commission doesn't understand our codes or their role, or the process was flawed, or I don't understand what's going on. So that's what I was asking for. And I got a good explanation from our planning director and our legal department. And I'd say it's a little bit of all of that, you know. So here it is. There's the conversation. And if people are curious, they can go back and look at the minutes of the Planning Commission. They can, you know, talk to us or come and ask for a further, deeper inquiry. But the process was legitimate. The codes were met. And we're going to have affordable housing down there. And I guess, you know, at the end of it all, that's good. And at the end of it all, also having this conversation lends transparency and credibility and legitimacy to the process, which I also believe is good. So their frustration has been recognized and acknowledged. My frustration has been recognized and acknowledged, and I think that benefits the community.
Okay. Park City Council Member Tim Henney, thanks. 8:47, good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the Local News Hour on KPCW. Coming up on Tuesday, state representatives will be in Summit County to kick off the 25K Jobs Tour. On the phone with details, I have Derek Miller. He's president and CEO of World Trade Center Utah. Good morning, Mr. Miller.
Leslie, great to be with you this morning.
So tell us, what is this all about? 25,000 jobs?
Well, we have a goal in this state. It was set by Governor Herbert, announced in his State of the State address last January as the legislative session began, that he wanted to see 25,000 jobs created in the 25 counties off the Wasatch Front. And as you and most people know, the state of Utah has been experiencing extraordinary job growth, but that is not true in all parts of our state. We see most of the job growth happening along the Wasatch Front, of course, some in Summit County, where you're at, and on the Wasatch Back, but there are other parts of our state that are not seeing the same kind of job growth that we're seeing on the Wasatch Front. And so the governor's concerned about that. He wants all 29 counties to be healthy. And so one of the things that we're doing is launching this 25,000 jobs tour.
So, it, as I mentioned, you'll be in Summit County on Tuesday. Who's coming?
We have 25 different service providers who are going to be coming to every one of the 25 counties. But as you mentioned, on Tuesday, July 18th, we will be at the North Summit High School, and we'll be talking about with these service providers all of the resources that exist to help these businesses to grow.
And this is happening at what time?
This will be in the evening at North Summit High School. This will run from 4 until 7 on Tuesday the 18th.
All right. And then the plan is to visit all 25 of these here, what, in the next month or so?
Well, give us a few weeks. There's obviously a lot of territory to cover. Over the next couple months, we'll be going to all 25 counties. We've actually been to Morgan County already. We had great success. We were there at the city park. We had about 200 people representing a lot of different businesses. They were learning about things like how to create a business plan, how to find financing for your business, how to find more customers, how to increase your market, what kind of grants exist to help companies to grow. And so whatever the business is, whatever the industry, whatever the stage of the company, whether it's just an idea that you have or whether you've got a long-standing established company and you're just looking to get into new markets or maybe new products, there'll be something for everybody.
So do you need to RSVP or you can just show up?
Just show up. We'd love for as many people to come as possible. You can find out more at our website, which is 25kjobs.com. And if you go to that website, you can find all the dates for all the different events. But people do not need to RSVP. Just come between 4 and 7 to North Summit High School, and we'll look forward to seeing people there.
Now, what's your role in all of this? I mean, as a business leader, how are you helping?
Well, at the World, specifically the World Trade Center Utah, we're one of the service providers. And, of course, what we do is we help Utah businesses go into international markets. So for us, it's all about making more at home and selling more abroad. But every single business leader that's there, and that includes the lieutenant governor, who came, of course, from the private sector, this will all be about helping to accelerate private sector job growth. That's the goal.
Well, as you may know, we have plenty of jobs available here in the Park City area. They're service industry jobs, and so they pay at maybe minimum wage, maybe a tad more. Certainly not enough to afford the rents that we're seeing here in the Summit County area. So when we talk about creating jobs, what kind of jobs do we want to create? I mean, I'm guessing jobs that pay a living wage.
Yeah, Leslie, you're bringing up a really excellent point, which is these 25 counties are not all the same. They don't have the same needs. They don't have the same goals. They don't have the same infrastructure. And so one of the things that we've been doing is we've created a steering committee within each of the 25 counties. And it's not as if we're just going to show up and then start having the discussion. We've been having the discussion with local elected officials, with mayors, with city council members, with county commissioners, with local economic development people. And the conversation has all been around, here are the resources that we have statewide. What are the needs that you have in your local community? And you've articulated what the needs are in a place like Summit County, which is going to be very different than a place like Sevier County. And so for Summit County, this is all about diversifying the economy. And so those are the kinds of discussions we're having, and the focus we'll be putting. And again, it's very locally driven.
Yeah, it's also very culturally driven. Yeah, I mean, is that what you're seeing? Because when we talk about, well, with the whole issue of public lands and how there are used to be the good jobs of extracting, of mining, of ranching, those jobs are kind of falling by the wayside. But I think it's something that the state, or at least residents within those communities, would like to see brought back, huh?
It is very different as you go from county to county. When you talk about our energy counties, as an example, when you talk about the Uinta Basin, of course, Uinta and Duchesne counties, you talk about Carbon and Emery counties. Just speaking on a personal level, at the World Trade Center, Utah, we've been very focused on working with businesses in those counties at diversifying their markets. I'll give you a quick example of a company that was in the drilling industry. And when drilling reduced out in the Uinta Basin, this company was really on the brink of bankruptcy. This was just last year. We were able to go in and talk to them about diversifying their markets and not just selling to local drillers, but taking their drilling products that they manufacture in Utah and start selling them in places like the Middle East. Well, last year they were on the brink of bankruptcy, and this year they had their most profitable year. So it's not just community by community. It's actually business by business and helping them solve their individual problem.
Okay. Again, the launch of the 25K Jobs Tour here in Summit County, Tuesday, North Summit High School, 4 to 7 p.m. Come learn how to grow your business, how to find a job through the Department of Workforce Services. And again, it's all free and open to the public.
Derek, thanks, Leslie. Great to be with you.
Thanks for your time.